Whether or not Iris and Davin, especially Davin, will be allowed to leave Tellisburg is going to depend on a lot of different factors, Zevons continued. According to the information I've received from Merlin, their Majesties, Duke Pinehollow and Archbishop Michael, would all vastly prefer to see Davin returned to his father's throne, in accordance with the terms of the peace settlement signed in his name by his Regency Council. His eyes met the Earl's. If he can accept that in good conscience, no one will attempt to compel him to do so. However, under those circumstances, he'll remain their Majesty's guest in Tellisburg indefinitely. I've been told to assure you he'll be treated with all the respect his birth and title command, and that his person will be sacrosanct. But I'm afraid that stipulation is non-negotiable. I assumed it would be, Cora said heavily. And I won't pretend I'm delighted to hear it. Iris won't like it either. I think she's genuinely accepted that Caleb didn't order her father killed, but in many ways she still holds him responsible for Hector's death. If Kharis hadn't invaded Coruscant, he'd still be alive after all. That's how she sees it, at any rate. I think she's probably even prepared to admit, intellectually, and only under duress, possibly, but to admit that Caleb didn't have much choice about invading, but what the head understands is sometimes difficult for the heart to accept, especially when you're only 20 years old. Trust me, if there's anyone in this world who understands that, it's Emperor Charlion, Zevon said quietly. I won't presume to speak for the Empress, but I believe she'll be as gentle with both Iris and Davin as she possibly can. Despite our anti-Charlion propaganda in Coruscant, that's what I'd expect as well, Corus admitted. To be honest, it's one reason I was prepared to approach her and Caleb in the first place. Although, if I'm going to be completely honest, the fact that they were the only people in the world who might be able to protect my prince and his sister from the people bent on murdering both of them was an even bigger factor in my thinking. He smiled humorlessly. What's that old saying about any port in a storm? Especially if it's the only port available. Then I should assume you and Iris are willing to accept the conditions I've just described. You should, Corus affirmed. I've already warned Iris that Caleb and Charlion would require what you've just described at a minimum. Her brother's all she has left, Master Zevons. She's prepared to swallow far worse than that as the price of keeping him alive. In fact, he broke off, waving one hand in a dismissing gesture, and Zevons cocked an eyebrow at him. You were about to say something, my lord. I was going to observe, Corus said after a long, thoughtful moment, that from everything I've ever learned of Emperor Charlion, she and Iris have a great deal in common, including an absolute, unswerving determination to avenge their father's murders. I don't say Iris is going to be prepared to accept Carisian dominion over Coruscant, because, frankly, she is her father's daughter, and she's thinking in terms of protecting her brother's birthright. But I will say that insofar as she can, without prejudicing Davin's claim to the Coruscantian throne, she's probably at least as hungry to see Clintan's blood as any Carisian could possibly be. I think there's at least the possibility of an understanding in that. That would be most welcome, my lord, Zevon said frankly. On the other hand, within the conditions I've already described, their Majesty's decision stands. Whether she and Davin are ever prepared to accept an accommodation with the Carisian crown or not. And, to be honest, those conditions are more generous than I would have anticipated, Corus admitted. I'm beginning to suspect that honesty, compassion, and fairness are much more dangerous weapons than most of us duplicitous diplomats have begun to realize even now. probably because until Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlion came along, we'd had so little exposure to them. It's going to take a while for us to develop proper immunity to them. Their Majesties do seem to have that effect on people, my lord, Sebons acknowledged with a grin. Then he turned serious again. The other message I'm here to deliver is that your proposed plan for getting Iris and Davin out isn't going to work. I realize it's a little risky, Corus began, but I've done some preliminary spade work, and I'm aware of that, my lord. I'm afraid, however, that both Duke Pearlman and Duke Ashton have been more thoroughly infiltrated by the Inquisition than they realize. I'm also aware that neither of them knows at this point that they're actually dealing with you or that the two Delphiracan nobles you're trying to sneak out are Iris and Davin. Once the hue and cry goes up after you disappear from Talkaira, however, it isn't going to take either of them long to realize who you and the children really are. And at that point, even if they don't decide to hand you over to the Inquisition, which, frankly, I think they probably would, you're bound to be spotted by the Inquisition and taken into custody. But, Corus began, his expression worried. My lord, I said your original plan wouldn't work. Not that we can't get you out, Zevon said calmly, and the Earl closed his mouth abruptly. At this time, a Carisian naval squadron is on its way to Sarmath, the Sagin continued. When it arrives there, it will seize the port and spend some time wrecking it from one end to the other. While it's doing that, a party of Carisian seamen and marines will take advantage of the confusion and general hullabaloo to head up the Sarm by boat. They should be able to make it all the way to Yarth, and a lot faster than they could make the same trip overland. You'll meet them in the Sarmon Mountains, then travel downriver to the naval squadron, which will deliver you to Tellersburg. That might work, Corus said slowly, his eyes thoughtful. It's what, about 250 miles from Talkaira to Yardan, isn't it? By road, yes, Zevons agreed. It's only about 180 miles in a straight line, though. And frankly, if you try to go by road, they'll run you down long before you get there. For that matter, they'll simply send word ahead to Bishop Shermak in Yardan by semaphore, and have him or Duke Yarth's armsman waiting when you get there. He shook his head. You'll have to go cross-country. That's going to be hard with the boy Davin's age, Corus pointed out. He was a good horseman for his age before we left Coruscant, but he's had very little opportunity to ride since we got here. I think we can deal with that, but none of us know the terrain between here and Yarth. His expression was worried. I don't like the thought of having to recruit a guide on such short notice. That won't be necessary, my lord, Zevon smiled. I'm afraid I'm going to be occupied elsewhere, but their majesties have decided getting you, Davin, and Iris safely to Tellersburg takes precedence over almost anything else. That being the case, they are prepared to commit whatever resources it takes. And Sagin Merlin's been on his way here almost since the moment your message arrived in Tellersburg. In fact, he's probably a lot closer already than you'd believe he could be. You'd be astonished by how quickly he can cover ground when he needs to. Merlin will be our guide? Corus repeated very carefully. Among other things, my lord. Among other things. Zevon smiled oddly. I think you'll find he's a handy fellow to have around in a lot of ways. And the smile disappeared. He has a remarkably short way with assassins.
3. Sarmath Keep and HMS Destiny 54. Sarmath, Kingdom of Delphirac.
Shit.
Colonel Stiven Wall's Royal Delphiracan Army clutched wildly at the railing as the entire fortress of Sarmath Keep seemed to buck under a fresh wash of explosions. He smelled stone dust, powder smoke, wood smoke, blood, and fear, and he shook his head, trying to clear his brain and figure out what the Shanwei was happening. He managed to stay on his feet and dragged himself the rest of the way up the internal stair while those infernal guns were reloading. He reached the top of the elevated battery covering the Sam River estuary and crouched low as he scuttled out towards the dubious shelter of the crenellated battlements. The sky was salmon and rose in the east, still dark blue in the west, and streaked with blue-grey clouds which hadn't yet caught the sunlight overhead. The pre-dawn twilight made the blinding fury of the long tongues of flame spurting from the broadsides of the Carisian galleons even more terrifying, and he wondered if that was one of the reasons for their timing. "Bastards have more guts than sense to sail straight up the estuary in the dark," he thought as their royal masts began to catch the dawn light, gleaming golden above the low-lying fog banks of gun smoke rolling slowly north on the wind blowing in from the sea. The galleons had just enough sail set to hold them motionless against the river's current, while they flailed his fortress with their guns. "Damned Carisians! They think they can go any damn where they've got 3 inches of water to sail in." The thought would have been more comforting if the Carisian Navy didn't regularly demonstrate that it could go anywhere it had 3 inches of water to sail in. And Carisian arrogance or not, they were damned well here now. Another salvo rippled down the side of the third galleon in the Carisian line, each gun obviously individually laid and fired, and walls ducked instinctively, trying to ooze out flat on the gun platform behind the battlement's protection as the exploding shot streaked towards the fortress. An artillerist himself by training, the colonel was almost as astonished by the elevation of the ship's guns as by what they were firing at him. Their damned, incredible exploding shot arced upward, tracing lines of fire across the half-dark, and dropped nearly over the top of the curtain wall. He kept his head down and prayed the rest of his men were doing the same. He'd already almost gotten himself killed gawking at the round shots skittering around the parade ground like Shanwei's bowling balls, while sparks and flame spat from them. He had realized those sparks had to be coming from fuses of some sort barely in time, and flung himself to the ground just as they began exploding. At least 50 of Sarmath Keep's understrength garrison had been less fortunate, or slower to react. Half his total manpower had to be out of action by now, and the fury of the Carisian bombardment was only mounting. He had tried to man his own artillery and return fire, but Sarmath Keep wasn't, or hadn't been, considered a likely target. King Zaim's purse was shallower than usual these days, and Wall's garrison was made up of old men past their prime. Young men who didn't yet have a clue, and gutter-scraping mercs the Crown could pick up cheap. He did have a reasonably solid corps of non-coms, but the total surprise when the first Carisian ship opened fire had panicked most of his men. He didn't suppose he could blame them for that, since he'd felt pretty jam-panicked himself. Yet he'd been in the process of restoring order when that first broadside of exploding shot came over the curtain wall and exploded, just as his sergeants had gotten them fallen in on the parade ground. They'd gone down like tenpins, except, of course, that tenpins didn't roll around on the grass screaming while they tried to hold their own ripped-out guts in place. The handful of men who had actually gotten to their guns and tried to man them had fared almost worse than the ones on the parade ground as the Carisian swept in close and hammered the battery embrasures with storms of grapeshot. Sarmath Keep's artillery had never been updated, and Colonel Walls had never encountered the new-style guns the Carisians had introduced. Now he had, and none of the reports he had heard about them had done them justice. He couldn't believe the rapidity of those galleons' fire, or the tempest of grapeshot which had silenced his own guns in such short order. "Sir," his second-in-command shouted in his ear, shaking him by the shoulder. "Sir, this is useless."
The second barracks block's on fire, and it's right next to the main magazine. We're not even getting a shot off, and they're blowing us to hell." The colonel stared at the other man, unwilling to accept what he was saying. But then another wave of exploding shots slammed into his compound, and he heard fresh screams. His jaw tensed, and he nodded once, choppily. "Hold down the flag," he grated. "Then get our people into the best cover we can find, if we can find any, until they stop shooting at us."
"Well, that was using a hammer to crack an egg, wasn't it?" Sir Duncan Yearley said mildly as the flag above the battered, smoking, burning keep came down like a shot wyvern.
"Personally, I'm in favour of doing just that, Sir Duncan," Captain Lathick replied, grinning fiercely. "Not any more eager to kill people than the next fellow, you understand, sir. But if somebody's got to get killed, I'd a lot rather it was the other fellow's people."
"I can't argue with that, Robert."
"And Captain Raswell did us proud, didn't he?" the Admiral continued, looking to turn at HMS Volcano as her crew began securing her guns.
"He did indeed, sir. A useful fellow to have along."
"Agreed." Yearley gazed at the bombardment ship for a moment, then beckoned to his flag lieutenant. Aplin Armack crossed his quarterdeck and stood waiting respectfully while the Admiral examined him.
"I assume you're ready and, like every young lieutenant who's yet to develop a working brain, eager to go, Hector?" he said finally.
"I wouldn't say eager, sir," Aplin Armack replied, "but my boat crew's waiting. Well, actually, I suppose your boat crew."
"They're yours for the moment," Yearley reminded him. "And keep an eye on that rascal Malik. Don't let him damage my paintwork."
"I'll make sure he behaves himself, sir," the flag lieutenant promised.
"See that you do. Now go. I believe you have a little trip to make."
"Aye, aye, sir."
The lieutenant touched his chest in salute, first to Yearley, then to Captain Lathick, and headed for the boat hooked onto Destiny's main chains. He didn't look back, and Yearley watched him go, then shook his head.
"Young Hector will do just fine, Sir Duncan," Lathick said quietly, and Yearley cocked his head at his flag captain.
"That obvious, was I? Well, we've served together for a while now, you and I, sir.
And young Hector, for that matter," Lathick shrugged.
"I don't think everyone in Destiny's guessed how you feel about the lad, though. Why, I'm sure there's some assistant cook's mate who hasn't noticed at all."
"I see why the men think so highly of your sense of humour, Captain," Yearley said dryly. But Lathick only smiled, saluted, and turned away to see to continuing his ship the rest of the way up the estuary to the town of Sarmouth itself. Yearley watched him go, and the truth was that the flag captain's humour had helped, a little at least. On the other hand, if anything happened to Aplin Armack, the Admiral knew he'd spend the rest of his life second-guessing himself. He'd had no specific orders to send the youngster upriver, and he was quite certain any number of other captains and flag officers would have been horrified by his decision to detail a member of the Imperial family, even an adoptive member of the Imperial family, to such a risky venture. But the Carisian Navy's tradition was that neither birth nor rank exempted a man from the risks everyone else ran. And trying to wrap the boy, the young man now, in cotton to protect him would have done no one any favours. All the same, he wondered sometimes if some perverse streak inside him kept goading him into sending Aplin Armack into danger in an effort to prove, possibly only to himself, that he was willing to do it, or as some sort of bizarre counterweight for how fond of the boy he'd become. In this case, however, given who the boat party was supposed to pick up, Aplin Armack was actually a logical choice. In some ways, at any rate. And as long as one could overlook the probability of getting a member of the Imperial family killed, of course. Not likely to enhance a flag officer's future career, that.
"Oh, stop it, Duncan. The boy's in no more danger than anyone else you're sending with him. The experience will do him good. and Lieutenant Gawain's a good, competent officer. He'll keep Hector out of trouble. Sir Duncan Yearley took a deep breath, clasped his hands behind him, put Lieutenant Aplin Armagh firmly out of his mind, and began to pace slowly up and down the weather hammock nettings while he watched his squadron advance on the hapless little town they'd come to destroy. 4. Siddar City, Republic of Siddermark.
"Kill the heretics! Burn the bastards out!"
The raucous shout went up from somewhere deep inside the mob, and other voices took up the refrain, bellowing the words in an ugly, hungry rhythm. It sounded like the snarl of some huge beast, not something born of human throats. It was still several blocks away, but Burke Raymond's heart plummeted as he heard it coming.
"Come on, Grandfather," he said,
reaching out and actually grasping Clayton Raymond's arm as if to drag him bodily out of the courtyard. The old man, he was in his 60s, his hair shining like snow in the cold winter sunlight, was still powerfully built, and he jerked his arm out of his grandson's grasp.
"Damn it, Burke," he snarled. "This is our home. I'm not handing it over to a mob of street scum."
For a moment, Burke seriously contemplated knocking him unconscious and simply hauling his limp body down the street. Claytown might still be a fit, muscular man, but Burke had spent the last 5 years sparring with some of the finest boxing coaches available in Tellisberg's and now Siddar City's gymnasiums. A quick jab to the solar plexus to bring his grandfather's hands down, then a right hook to the jaw would do the trick, he thought grimly. But he couldn't do that, of course. Not to his grandfather. And because he couldn't, he stepped back, drew a deep breath, and made his voice come out flat and hard.
"We've got to go. Go now, while there's still time."
"This is our home," Clayton repeated. "And it's a lot safer place to be than getting caught in the street by those thugs. The city guard's bound to turn up soon, and when it does..."
"The guard isn't going to get here, not in time to do any good," Burke said,
hating himself for the words as he saw the look in his grandfather's eye. Yet they had to be said. "And we're in the richest part of the quarter. Those bastards out there will make burning us out a priority. I know you don't like the thought, but we've got to go." "And where do you propose we go to?"
"I know a place. A place where we'll be safe, or at least, if we're not safe there, we won't be safe anywhere in Siddar City."
"Then go," Clayton snapped. "Take your grandmother and go." "But I didn't give up everything in Tellisberg just to let gutter trash and street scum drive me out of my home here."
"Grandfather, they may be street scum," Burke said as reasonably as he could, "but there are hundreds of them. You wouldn't stand a chance of stopping them. All you'd manage to do is get yourself killed."
"And if I choose..." Clayton began. But for the first time since he'd been a passionate, adolescence-driven 15-year-old, Burke cut him off in mid-sentence.
"And if you choose to stay here and get yourself killed, Grandmother will stay with you. There's no way she'll run away and leave you. And neither will I, you stubborn, stiff-necked, obstinate..."
He made himself stop and glared at his grandfather. Eyes of Rayman Brown locked with eyes of Rayman Brown, and after a brief, titanic moment, it was Clayton's which fell.
"Grandfather, I understand."
Burke reached out again, resting his hands on Clayton's shoulders. "You've never run from anything in your life, and giving ground before a mob comes hard. I know that. But I don't want to see you die, and I know you don't want to see Grandmother die, so please, can we get out of here, you stubborn old gentleman?" Clayton stared at him for a moment, then surprised himself with a harsh laugh. He put his right hand over the younger, stronger hand resting on his left shoulder just for a moment, then he nodded sharply.
"My legs aren't as young as they used to be," he said. "So if we're going to be running away, what say we see if we can't get a good head start?"
Samuel Nagel gave a yell of delight as he used the smouldering slow match to light the rag stuffed into the neck of the bottle of lamp oil and threw the incendiary through the display window. Glass shattered, and a moment later he smelled smoke and saw the spreading pool of fire flickering in the depths of the shop. Racks of dry goods and bolts of cloth began to smoulder, taking flame quickly, and Nagel's eyes glowed. This was better even than bedding a woman. There was a power, a wild, fierce freedom, in finally freeing the anger which had boiled inside him for so long. Smoke rose from other shop fronts all around him as the mob rampaged through the Corisian quarter, torching everything in sight. Fortunately, the wind was out of the northwest. It would blow the wind and cinders away from the central part of the city, and if they happened to set fire to the harbourside tenements where the filthy Corisians lived like so many spider rats in a city garbage dump, so much the better. He turned away from the burning shop, reaching into his satchel, and heard a shrill scream. He looked up just in time to see three or four more young men, his age or a little older, run down a girl who couldn't have been more than 15. They trapped her against the wall of a building, and she cowered back against it, head darting around frantically, looking for any escape. Then she made a desperate dash for an alley mouth, but one of her pursuers caught up with her first. She cried out again in mingled terror and pain, as he wrapped his hand in her hair and jerked her off her feet. Nagel heard her crying out, begging, pleading, imploring anyone to help her, and he smiled. He watched them dragging her by the hair down the alley where the little Corisian bitch had thought she might find safety, and then he drew another bottle from his satchel, lit the rag, and threw it through another shop window.
"Behind me! Now!"
Salis Traskat snapped. Myram Traskat looked up, then gasped and stumbled back behind her husband. She clutched 3-year-old Sinday, the youngest, in her arms, while 7-year-old Powell clung to her skirts, their eyes huge with terror as the bedlam thundered around them. 13-year-old Martin pushed himself in front of her, behind her father, his face white and frightened, but determined. Behind the boy, Myram darted her head around, looking for any escape. But with two small children, outdistancing pursuit was out of the question. Traskat knew exactly what was going through his wife's mind, and his own terror was as deep as her own. Not for himself, but for her and the children. Only he couldn't let that terror paralyze him, and he glared at the three men sauntering arrogantly towards them. He knew two of them, longshoremen like himself, but definitely not Corisians, and both of them with knives thrust through their belts. The third was a stranger, but he carried a sword, and there was a cruel, eager glitter in his eyes. "Stay with your mother, Martin," he said quietly, his voice iron with command, never taking his own eyes from the other men. "Whatever else happens, look after your mother and the babies."
"Well, well, well," the sword-armed man called mockingly. "What do we have here?"
"Pretty wife you've got there, Traskat," one of the longshoremen said, reaching down and rubbing his crotch suggestively, while his fellow leered and drew the foot-long knife from his belt, testing its edge with a gloating thumb. "Going to enjoy showing her a really good time." Traskat's face tightened, and he brought up the baseball bat. He'd had that bat for more years than he could remember. He had broken plenty of others over the years, but never this one. It had always been his lucky bat, and he'd brought it with him from Telisberg when he left the Krakens behind with the rest of his heretical homeland. Somehow he didn't feel lucky today.
"Ooh! What's he going to do with the big bad baseball bat?"
the sword-armed man taunted in a high-pitched falsetto. He raised his own weapon, smoky light gleaming on its point.
"Come on, baseball man, show us what you've got."
"Salis, Myram's voice was frightened, and he heard his younger children weeping in terror. But he never took his eyes from the men in front of him.
"Now!"
the swordsman shouted, and the hunting pack charged. Sales Traskat had a lifetime professional batting average of 302. He had always been a strong man, but not especially fast, so he'd been forced to hit for power rather than rely on speed on the bases. Over the years, he'd developed rather amazing bat speed, and the longshoreman with the drawn knife made the mistake of getting a little in front of the others. The same bat, which had hit 23 home runs in Sales Traskat's last season with the Tellersburg Krakens, hit him squarely in the forehead with a terrible crunching, crushing, squashing sound. He didn't even scream. He simply flew backward, knife spinning away through the air, blood spraying from his shattered forehead, and Traskat stepped to his left. The baseball bat slashed over and around in a flat, vicious figure eight. The other longshoreman saw it coming. His eyes flared with sudden panic as his right hand fumbled frantically at the hilt of his knife, and the other arm rose to fend off the blow. But he was too slow, and the panic in his eyes disappeared as they went unfocused and forever blank, as the end of the bat caved in his right temple with contemptuous ease. That quickly, that suddenly, Traskat found himself facing only one opponent, and the swordsman looked down at the two corpses sprawled untidily in the street. His eyes darted back up to Traskat and the blood-dripping bat poised in the big Carizian's powerful hands, and Traskat smiled at him. "That's what I'm going to do with the big, bad baseball bat, you bastard," he said, all the resentment and anger he'd felt since coming to Siddhar City roaring up inside him with his terror for his family's safety. "You want a piece of me, a piece of my family? You bring it on, goddamn you, you bring it on!" The swordsman stared at him, then stepped back, retreating, but it was only a feint. The instant Traskat's bat started to dip, the man threw himself forward again. Yet he wasn't the only one who'd been capable of fainting. As he came forward, the bat which had been waiting the entire time came up again, arcing from below belt level, catching his sword on the flat of the blade and flinging it to one side, then crunching into the underside of his jaw. The swordsman screamed, teeth and blood flying. He dropped the sword, clutching at his shattered face with both hands, as he stumbled the rest of the way forward, and Traskat stepped out of his path. The man lurched, starting to go to his knees, and that terrible baseball bat slammed into the back of his skull like the Rakurai of Langhorn. He hit the pavement in a puddle of blood, and Traskat looked down at him, breathing hard. "Threaten my family, will you?" he hissed, and kicked the dead man in the ribs. Then he looked at his wife and children. "Are you all right?" he demanded. Myram nodded mutely, her eyes huge, shaking with terror and reaction. Martin, he saw, had already pounced on the knife his first victim had lost, and if the foot of steel shook in his hand, his eyes were grim and determined. Those eyes were shocked by what they'd just seen, but they met his father's levelly, and Traskat's heart filled with pride. And then young Powell, still clinging to his mother's skirt with one hand, pointed with the other. "Daddy," he said, 7-year-old voice quivering with fear and yet reaching for some comforting familiarity in a world which had gone insane. "Daddy, you broke your bat."
"Come on," Major Borry Sadler barked. "We're behind schedule already."
"So what?" Kale Kalitz shot back.
He waved his sword at the smoke belching from burning shops and tenements, the motionless bodies littering the streets and sidewalks, and laughed drunkenly.
"This is the most fun we've had in years. Give the lads a little slack."
Sadler glared at him, but Kalitz only looked back at him unrepentantly. The Major's second-in-command was intoxicated with violence and the release of long-held hatred, and in some ways
That was worse than anything wine or whiskey might have produced.
Damn Father Samon,
Sadler thought bitterly, even though he knew he shouldn't, but still. He made himself draw a deep breath of smoky air. As one of the handful of Inquisition guardsmen who'd been smuggled into Siddhar City as part of the planning for the Sword of Shula, Sadler had done his best to instill some sort of discipline into the volunteers Father Samin and Leon Bazkai were recruiting. Unfortunately, his superiors had been too enthralled by Father Samin's reports to listen to his own warnings that the loyal sons of Mother Church were far more enthusiastic than organized or experienced. It was one thing to smuggle in weapons. It was quite another to train civilians in their use. Even people like Kaelit, who had served as a member of the capital militia, had strictly limited training compared to their regular army counterparts. Nor had it been possible for Sadler to rectify those shortcomings. Actually, training any large body of men required space and time, and it wasn't something which could be done in secret, in the middle of a Shanwei-damned city. He'd done his best, but the unfortunate truth was he'd been largely restricted to lecturing Father Samin's officers on theory, and that was no substitute for hands-on time working with their weapons and their troops. He deeply envied his fellows who'd been sent to less citified parts of the operation. Scattered around the estates of temple loyalists in the Republic's central and western provinces, where farmers, foresters, miners and rural craftsmen already resented the wealth of the eastern province's urban populations, they'd been able to actually drill the men they were responsible for leading. They'd been able to put them together and train them as units, accustomed to taking orders and obeying them. Sadler had warned Father Samin, and even Father Zohans, that without the same opportunity, he and his subordinate commanders were unlikely to retain control of their units here in the capital when the day finally came. It wasn't the men's motivation he mistrusted. It wasn't even their willingness to take orders. It was their reliability. They'd never been given the chance to acquire the habit of obeying their officers when the violence actually began. But had Father Samon listened? Of course he hadn't. And neither had Father Zohans. Or Sandler was confident neither of them had allowed it to colour any of their reports to Archbishop Willem, or the Grand Inquisitor at any rate. And Father Samin was probably right that it wasn't going to matter in the end. It had become apparent over the last few 5 days that the government had started to realize, at least dimly, that trouble was brewing. They obviously hadn't guessed how deep their danger truly was, however, or they'd have taken more precautions. True, Darius Parker's decision to empty most of the capital militia's arsenals and send the weapons to be held under guard at Fort Raymere, the main army base north of the city, had deprived the insurgents of arms Father Samin had assumed would be available. But Fort Raymere was 15 miles from the capital, and the army was under strength at the moment. Despite a few belated troop movements, there couldn't be more than 5,000 men stationed at Raymere, and they were peacetime soldiers with a peacetime mentality. They'd need time to get themselves organized and move, and they'd be badly outnumbered if even 2/3 of the men Father Samin had promised would join the insurgency actually turned up. There was time, Sandler told himself. And so far the uprising's sheer suddenness and ferocity were carrying everything before them. But it was messy. And it was throwing him behind schedule. He should already have reached Constitution Square and the Lord Protector's Palace, and here he was instead, trying to drag his men away from the arson and looting, and undoubtedly rape, he thought bleakly, looking at a half-naked young woman lying sprawled in death, almost at his feet, going on throughout the Corisian quarter. Damn it, Father Samin and Bazkai had other groups poised and ready for that part of the operation, and they were doing it.
The smoke and screams and bodies were proof enough of that. He was supposed to be making certain Stonar and his accursed minions didn't manage to escape. The last thing they needed was for those bastards to get away to some place like Caris and try to foment trouble back here on the mainland from their safe, comfortable exile. "They can have all the slack they want once we've got Stonar and his council in the bag," he snapped, glaring at Caelid. "Are they here to do God's will, or simply to steal anything they can't burn?" The question came out with deliberate, sneering contempt, and Caelid's eyes flashed with anger, which was exactly what Sadler had wanted. "We're not just a bunch of thieves," he shot back furiously. "No?" Sadler matched him glare for glare for a moment, then allowed his own expression to soften slightly. "I don't think you are," he said. "But that's what we're acting like, and we've got more important things to do." He held the other man's eyes for another heartbeat, then hardened his voice again. "So let's get them moving again, shall we?" Caelid looked around, as if truly seeing the confusion and the chaos for the first time. Then he gave himself a visible shake and looked back at Sadler. "Yes, sir." His sword flipped up in salute. "I'll do that little thing." He turned away and started bellowing orders at their smaller unit commanders, and Sadler nodded in satisfaction. "Langhorn," Gregor Stonar muttered, standing on the balcony of one of the Lord Protector's palace's ornate towers. The official seat of the Republic's government had never been designed as a serious fortification. Its defence was the Sidamachian army and its pikemen, not stone and mortar. Now, as he watched smoke rising over the city, and not just over the Carisian quarter any longer, he found himself wishing its architects had given just a little more attention to stopping blood-maddened street mobs short of the Chamber of the Senate and the Hall of Records. "And don't forget about short of your own hide, Gregor," he reminded himself grimly. "Where the hell are they all coming from?" he demanded. "I don't know," Henry Maiden admitted. The Chancellor pointed out across the city at the scores of smoke columns rising from the Carisian quarter. "I didn't think they had enough manpower to do that and come after the palace." He shook his head, and his expression was grim. Stonar nodded. Part of him wanted to lash out at Maiden and point out that it had been his job to determine what was actually coming, but it would have been pointless. It would have been unfair, too, for that matter. The Chancellor had brought Stonar regular reports, and the Lord Protector had agreed with his conclusions. Only it appeared they'd both been wrong. "We should have detailed more troops to protect the palace," Maiden continued. "It's my fault. I'm the one who..." "It's not your fault, Henry," Stonar interrupted. "I agreed with you and Samuel that we had to give priority to protecting the quarter." He laughed harshly. "Not that it appears we're doing a lot of good over there, either." "Where the hell is Darius?" Maiden demanded, wheeling to glare towards the north. "What the hell is taking him so long?" "Probably more of that," Stonar replied, gesturing disgustedly at the burning tenements of the Carisian quarter. "Or more crap like it," he shrugged angrily. "I was wrong not to go ahead and muster the regulars right here in the city, and the hell with keeping them out of Rhaemir. Without a better indication the Wyvern was about to take flight, you couldn't risk warning." "Spare me the excuses," Stonar said wearily. Unlike Maiden, the Lord Protector had risen to regimental command before he left the army, returned to his native Siddar city, and entered politics. He should have remembered, he told himself. Whatever the arguments in favour of making certain Clintan was clearly guilty of the first move, he should have paid more attention to Darius Parker's argument that it was even more important they hang on to the capital in the first place. They could always argue over who'd started what later. Assuming they survived to do the arguing, the seneschal had observed acidly. And nobody who was inclined to believe Clintrane in the first place would be impressed by any claims the Republic was an innocent victim of the Grand Inquisitor's lust for vengeance, no matter how truthful they were. And I shouldn't have detailed so many of the troops we do have in the city to protect the quarter, he told himself even more grimly. He hated to even think thoughts like that. Yet there was a cold, bitter edge of truth to it. You wanted to prevent a massacre. Well, holding on to the damned capital would have helped a lot in that little endeavour. Instead, you parcelled your troops out in 10th-mark packets trying to protect the Carizians, and look at it. Accomplished one hell of a lot, didn't you? Now you're going to lose both of them. He forced himself to straighten his shoulders as he looked down into Constitution Square at the single regiment of pikemen deployed to cover the approaches to the palace. There weren't enough of them to cover all the entrances into the square, so they'd been stationed along the huge plaza's eastern edge to protect the enormous arched gate through the palace's ornamental outer wall. The wall would probably help some, but that regiment simply wasn't big enough to cover its entire length. And then there was that damned, wide-open gate. If enough rioters came storming across the square... "'It's not as bad as you think it is, Gregor,' he told himself harshly. "'You don't have a single reliable report about what's going on out there. "'Darius could be a lot closer than you think he is, "'and all that smoke is bound to make the situation in the quarter look worse than it really is. "'And however many men they may have in the streets, "'most of the population staying home and keeping its head down. "'It's not like the entire damn city is really up in arms.' So if you can just hang on long enough for Darius to get here. Burke Raymond looked back and swore with bitter, savage venom. They'd been lucky so far, but their luck had just run out. The outriders of the mob had spotted the small band of refugees he and his grandfather had collected on their flight towards the docks. Part of him had never wanted to slow down for a moment, but he'd been unable to harden his heart enough to ignore the tattered drifts of terrified people, more often than not women or children, who'd clustered around them. He suspected they'd been drawn by his grandparents' well-to-do appearance and the general aura of composure and command they couldn't help projecting, even in the middle of a murderous riot. But perhaps it had simply been the fact that the Raymonds were obviously going somewhere, not simply fleeing. It certainly couldn't have been because of how well-armed and numerous they were. He had realized immediately that the larger their group got, the slower it would become, and the more likely it would be to attract the human slash-lizards rampaging through the streets. But his grandparents would never have forgiven him for trying to shake off those terrified fugitives, and another part of him had been glad it was so. He knew he would never have forgiven himself later, not that it seemed he was likely to have the opportunity to worry about that, after all. He looked around quickly. There were perhaps a half-dozen other men his age or a few years older in their group. Fathers, most of them, he thought sickly, seeing how their wives and children clung to them. Another three or four were somewhere between them and his grandfather's age. That was it. And there had to be at least 100 men in the mob spilling into the avenue behind them. He stood for just a moment, then turned to his grandfather. "'Give me your sword,' he said. Clayton Raymond's hand fell to the hilt of the old-fashioned cutlass at his side, the one he'd carried as a young man on long-ago galleon decks, twin to the one hanging from the baldric, slung over his grandson's shoulder. "'Why?' he demanded, and managed a strained smile. "'Looks like I'm going to need it in a minute or so.' "'No, you're not,' Burke said flatly. "'You're going to take Grandmother and all the rest of these women and children to Harbour Hill Court, No. 7, Harbour Hill Court.' Clayton's eyes widened as he recognized Ava Parsan's address. "'There are arrangements to protect them there.' Burke stared into his grandfather's eyes.
and you're going to get them there, Grandfather. I'm depending on you for that.
Burke, I can't.
Clayton's voice was stricken, but there was no time for that, and Burke reached out and drew the older man's cutlass from its scabbard.
I love you, Grandfather, he said softly. Now go.
Clayton stared at him for a moment longer, then dragged in a ragged breath and turned to his weeping wife.
Come with me.
His voice frayed around the edges.
He's right.
Behind him, Burke was looking at the other men in their small group.
Who's with me?
He demanded. Two of the men, about his own age, looked away, their expressions shamed. They refused to meet his eyes, and he ignored them, looking at the others.
I am,
a roughly dressed fellow in his 40s said, hefting a truncheon he'd picked up somewhere along the way. He spat on the paving.
Legs are getting tired anyway.
Someone actually managed to laugh, and the others looked at Burke with frightened, determined faces.
Here.
He offered his grandfather's cutlass to a stocky, roughly dressed man carrying a badly cracked baseball bat crusted with blood. There was more dried blood on the fellow's tunic, although it was obvious none of it was his. Burke had no idea whether or not the other man had a clue about how to use a sword, but he was obviously determined enough to make a good try. The man looked at his bat. He hesitated for a moment, then grimaced.
Thanks.
He dropped the bat and took the cutlass, and Burke's eyebrows rose as he took two or three practiced cuts, obviously getting the weapon's feel.
Militiaman, back home, he explained.
Good. Glad to meet you, by the way. Burke, Rayman. Burke tapped his chest, and the other man snorted.
Sales. Sales Traska, he said,
then glanced down the street where the mob had clearly finished coalescing and was beginning to flow towards them.
Pleased to meet you.
Likewise. Burke drew a deep breath and looked around at his small band. It's pretty simple, he told them. We slow them down, right?
Right, the fellow with the truncheon said with a grim smile. And we take as many of the bastards with us as we can.
The others snarled in agreement and drew into a tighter knot around Burke in the centre of the street. Burke's heart thundered and his hands felt sweaty. Despite all the songs, he had never really believed battle and killing were glorious, and the truth was that he wanted nothing in this world so much as to run away. Well, either run away or throw up, he thought. But he couldn't, and he realized he wouldn't have if he could have. Something else rose up inside him to join the terror and the determination. Something hot and angry and bitter-tasting that seemed to quiver in his limbs. There were a lot of things he'd intended to do in his life, and regret flowed through him as he realized he wasn't going to get them done after all. Yet that savage eagerness to get on with it was stronger still.
Wait for it.
He heard a stranger saying with his own calm voice as the front of the mob accelerated towards them.
Let them come to us and stay together as long as we can. Die hard, the truncheon-armed man growled. Die hard, boys.
The mob swept towards them, baying its blood hunger, and the tiny knot of Carisians settled even more solidly in place. Burke watched the Sidomachians moving from a walk into a trot, and from a trot into a run, and...
Fire!
Another voice shouted suddenly, and the mob's howls of fury turned into sudden shrieks of terror, as something exploded deafeningly behind Burke, and 25 rifled muskets poured fire into them. Men went down screaming and twisting on the pavement, blood erupting as the heavy bullets ploughed furrows through them.
Second rank, fire!
The same voice shouted, and more thunder erupted. Burke spun towards the sound and saw a double line of men in civilian dress, one kneeling, the other standing, all armed with bayoneted rifles. Smoke spewed from the standing line's weapons, and more of the mob went down.
The musketeers were still outnumbered at least 3 or 4 to 1, but that commanding voice never hesitated.
"At the charge, boys!"
it shouted, and the musketeers howled the terrifying war cry of the Carizian marines as they lunged forward in a compact, deadly mass behind their bayonets. The mob was too tightly packed to evade them, and the hungry, hating shouts, which had whipped it along only seconds before, turned into screams of panic as it disintegrated into individual, terrified men desperately trying to get out of the way of those lethal, glittering bayonets. Bayonets that ran red moments later.
"Well, Burke," the voice of command shouted, "going to just stand there all day?"
Burke looked at the man who'd shouted, and Rafe Alexen grinned fiercely at him, then pointed at the fleeing mob with his ornately chased, blood-dripping rapier.
"Get a move on, man! Kill the heretics! Death to all traitors! Holy Langhorne and no quarter! Down with tyranny! Kill the bloodsuckers! Kill the Carizian lackeys! God wills it!"
"Well, it would have been nice if Darius had made it in time," Gregor Stonar thought, as the mob began to pour into Constitution Square from the west, behind the yammering thunder of its shouted slogans. There were at least 5 or 6,000 of them, he judged, with the eye of an ex-military officer who knew what 5 or 6,000 men standing in one place really looked like. There were quite a few men in cassocks and priests' caps as well. He couldn't make out colours very well from this distance, but he was willing to bet most of them were badged with the purple of the Order of Shula. He saw pikes and halberds waving here and there, but mostly swords, clubs, some pitchforks, weapons which could be easily concealed or improvised when the moment came. Maybe that was the reason he and Maiden had underestimated the potential numbers available to Potcover and Einhardt. They'd had their agents focused on looking for stores of heavier, more sophisticated weapons.
"Should have remembered. They can kill you just as dead with a cobblestone as a pike, Gregor," he told himself. "Of course, it is basically a mob, not an army. No telling how good their morale is. They may not have the stomach for it when they come up against formed troops. Then again," he thought as the screaming tide of humanity reoriented itself, coalesced, flowed together, and started across the square. "Maybe they will." He glared at that accursed ornamental gate in the palace's outer wall. What he wanted was a massive portcullis, preferably with murder holes and huge cauldrons of boiling oil and naphtha waiting for the torch. What he had was nothing at all. It had always been the Republic's boast that its citizens had access to the centre of its government without let or hindrance, which meant there was no gate set into that gleaming, sculpted archway. The damn thing was so wide it took an entire company of pikemen just to cover it too, and that was an entire company who'd had to be taken off the wall itself. The mob obviously recognized just how undermanned that wall was, and it seemed to be under at least rudimentary control by its leaders. Its center hung back slightly, threatening the gate arch, but keeping its distance while its flanks flowed forward. It was gradual at first, but the flanking groups moved more and more rapidly, charging for the extreme ends of the wall in an obvious effort to spread the single defending regiment even thinner.
"The bastards are coming over it," he told himself,
resting one hand on the hilt of the Republic sword of state, hanging from the baldric, looped across his right shoulder. That sword had belonged to Lord Protector Ludovic Erwin, the Republic's founder. He'd carried it through 12 campaigns and at least 20 battles, and despite all the gold and cut gems that had been added to it over the last 4 centuries, it was still a fighting man's weapon. If it had been good enough for the Republic's first Lord Protector, it would be good enough for the Republic's last Lord Protector when someone pried it from his dead hand.
Best be getting down there, Gregor. You'll get a chance to kill more of them at the wall than you will once they're inside, and...
His thoughts broke off as a sudden crashing roll of thunder exploded from the southern edge of the square. Boris Adler whipped around in shocked disbelief as the unmistakable sound of a musket volley crunched down on the mob's baying shouts like an iron boot. Gunsmoke spurted, rising all along the south side of Constitution Square, and for just an instant, the shattering, totally unexpected concussion of at least a couple of hundred muskets seemed to stun the mob into silence. Then the screams began again, but they were different this time. Sadler looked around, unable to see over the men packed between him and that wall of smoke. Then he turned and bulled his way through the shocked, motionless bodies around him until he reached the towering bronze equestrian statue of Ludovic Erwin. The complex tracery of its elaborate fountains hadn't been turned off for the winter yet, and he ignored their icy coldness as he hurdled the wall around the catch basin. He splashed through the knee-deep water, then clambered up onto the base of Erwin's statue, getting his head high enough to look across the square. He was only halfway there when the second volley roared out, and he had just reached the knees of Erwin's horse when a third volley exploded. Impossible, he thought, listening to that thunder of gunfire. We know exactly how many muskets they had in the city arsenals, and they sent all of them to Fort Raymier. They can't have that many of the damn things. But they did, and his blood ran cold as he finally got high enough to see. At least 1,000 men had poured into Constitution Square from the south, while the mob's attention was concentrated on the Lord Protector's palace. There wasn't a single pike among them, either. Every one of them was armed with a musket, and Sadler's belly twisted with sudden nausea as he realized they weren't matchlocks. They were the new model flintlocks, and they had the new bayonets as well, and that was just as impossible as all the rest of it. Mother Church had forbidden the Republic to purchase more than 5,000 of the new weapons, and Father Samin's agents knew where all 5,000 of those weapons had gone. Over 3,000 were at Fort Raymier, but that wasn't where these had come from. The men carrying them were no army musketeers. They wore civilian clothing of every imaginable colour and cut, but every single one of them also wore an identifying white sash from right shoulder to left hip. Sadler clung to his vantage point, and his eyes went cold and bleak as a fourth volley crashed out. There were only three ranks of the newcomers, which meant the first rank had fired and then reloaded in no more than 20 or 25 seconds, and that was vastly better than matchlocks could have done. Worse, the successive, deafening, smoky cracks of thunder had carpeted a sixth part of the square with dead, dying and wounded men. The newcomers were still outnumbered, badly, but they were a formed, cohesive unit, with all the organization his own mob lacked. Worse, they were far better armed, and their sudden, totally unanticipated appearance had stunned his own men. However willing the spontaneous mob might have been when it started out, no amount of willingness could armor it against that kind of surprise. And once a mob like this breaks, Shuler himself couldn't get it back together again, Sadler thought numbly. If it breaks once, it'll turn into a rabble forever, and then... A fifth volley roared, and then came an even more dreadful sound. The unmistakable high, baying howl of the Imperial Carisian Marines. No! Sandler shook his head in wild denial. Those can't be Marines. There's no way they could have gotten here, even if the Carisians had figured out what was coming, and... But it didn't matter whether or not Carisian Marines could be in the heart of Siddhar City. What mattered was that the mob, already worse than simply decimated by those deadly, crashing volleys, recognized the Marines' war cry when they heard it. And they knew what they and their fellows had already done to the Carisian quarter, and how Carisian Marines would react to that. 417 of the spontaneous rioters were trampled to death by their fellows trying to get out of Constitution Square in time. Little more than half of them made it.
Gregor Stonar passed through the Lord Protector's palace's gate with a guard of 30 pikemen. They had to pick their way carefully over Constitution Square's corpse-littered, blood-slick paving stones. No one had even begun to count the bodies yet, but there had to be at least a couple of thousand of them. He approached the command group of the mysterious musketeers who had appeared in the proverbial nick of time, and his eyebrows rose as a slender figure stepped forward to meet him. Slim hands rose, pushing back the hood of a heavy coat, and he inhaled deeply. They had never been introduced, but he recognized her without any trouble at all.
"Madam Parsan, I see," he said as calmly as he could.
"Lord Protector," she replied with a masculine bow some people might have criticized as scandalously abbreviated and informal, given Stonar's exalted position. Considering the circumstances under which he was alive to receive it, however, Stonar had no bone to pick with it.
"This is a surprise," he observed. And she laughed as if they were at one of her soirees rather than knee-deep in bodies in the heart of the Republic's capital.
"I'm sure Lord Henry's been keeping you apprised of most of my activities, my lord," she replied. "All of the ones he knew about, anyway." She gave him a dimpled smile. "Obviously, he didn't know about quite all of them."
"We were aware you'd acquired a modestly substantial number of rifled muskets, my lady," he responded. "Obviously, we didn't know everything we should have, of course. For example, none of us realized you'd somehow managed to train men to use them without anyone's noticing."
"Well, just buying guns and not learning how to use them properly would be pretty silly, don't you think?" She smiled again. "I'm sure Master Quentin told you I've been heavily in agriculture for years now as well. An interesting thing about a big commercial farm, my lord. It's got a lot of empty space. Plenty of room for 5 or 6 retired Carisian Marines to train men one company or so at a time without drawing a great deal of attention. Especially if you've taken pains over the years to turn any ears that might overhear them into friends of yours, by seeing to it that the local freeholders and their families are treated well."
"I suppose that's true," Stonar said. "And it would appear to be fortunate the group of 4 clearly underestimated you even more badly than we did."
"They've had more experience underestimating me than you might expect, my lord," she agreed, and this time her smile was cold and ugly. "This isn't the first time I've crossed swords, so to speak, with the Grand Inquisitor."
"No?"
He considered her for a moment, head cocked, then barked a laugh.
"Somehow I find that easy to believe, my lady. Might I assume that your opportune rescue of myself and my government indicates you intend to continue crossing swords with him?"
"Oh, I think you could, my lord." She smiled that cold, ugly smile again. "I think you could."
5. Psalm River, Kingdom of Delphirac.
"Easy," Lieutenant Aplin Armak said quietly, as the boat moved slowly towards the riverbank in the dim pre-dawn gloom. The water gleamed faintly as the first blush of yellow and rose touched the eastern horizon, and a wyvern whistled querulously from somewhere ahead of them.
"Over the side and find the bottom, Brazen," he continued. "Can't be too deep this close in."
"Easy for you to say if you don't mind me saying so, sir,"
Brazin, a tall young topman who'd been part of Malik's boat crew for over 2 years, replied feelingly.
"Oh, nonsense. Pretend it's beer. I know that'll make you feel better about it."
Several members of the boat crew chuckled, and Brazin grinned at the lieutenant.
"Does that mean you're buying when we get back to the ship, sir?" he asked,
and Aplin Armark laughed.
"For you?" the lieutenant shook his head. "I'd rather buy water for fish at whiskey prices. It had cost me less."
Brayson's grin got even bigger, and then he slipped over the side of the boat, hanging on to the gunwale, while his feet felt for the bottom.
"Don't like my beer quite this cold, sir," he informed Aplin Armark. "It's a mite... Ow!"
He yelped, hauling himself higher in the water and shaking his head.
"Found the bottom, sir. Little rocky for my taste."
"Then next time keep your shoes on, you stupid bugger," Stewart Malik suggested helpfully.
"Don't like squelching around in soggy shoes, coxswain,"
Brayson replied cheerfully.
"Just take us in, Malik," Aplin Armark said in a tone of exaggerated patience. "Lieutenant Gawain wants us hidden again before sunrise."
"Aye, aye, sir," Malik said.
"Give way all. And you, Brayson, keep your damn delicate tootsies out of the rock so you don't bruise them."
"Keep that in mind, I will, coxswain," Brayson assured him with another grin.
Aplin Armark shook his head, yet the banter between Malik and the members of his boat's crew was the best possible and welcome proof that the men's morale was doing just fine. They were just over 180 miles up the Sam River, two-thirds of the way across the sparsely populated earldom of Charles, and that was a long, twisty way from the salt water that was a Carizian sailor's natural element. True, rivers were full of water, but they were also full of rocks, bugs, and shallows where boats had to be dragged across sandbars or portaged around rapids. Fortunately, they hadn't encountered any waterfalls yet, at least, but they'd done extraordinarily well to average 3 miles per hour during the 14 or 15 hours of darkness and twilight available to them each day. He was glad they weren't doing this later in the spring, when the days would be longer. But there were downsides to rowing and sailing your way up an unknown river in the dark, especially for the boat Lieutenant Gawain had decided should scout ahead for the others. They seemed to spend a lot of time hopping in and out of it when it went aground, for example. Still, everyone seemed cheerful enough so far, and unusually, in Aplin Armark's experience, everything was actually going according to plan and, more or less, on schedule. "Which obviously means something's bound to go wrong sometime soon," he reflected, glancing over his shoulder at the silhouettes of the other, larger boats behind them. No one had noticed them when they first started upriver. The sun still hadn't risen when they went rowing past the Sarmouth waterfront, and given the dozens of other boats from the squadron which had been headed towards the waterfront with fell intent, it probably wasn't too surprising no one had paid them any attention. As an added touch, Admiral Yearley had ordered the boats repainted in mismatched shades of dirty white, grey, and black, and then scuffed the new paint in ways no navy bosun would ever have tolerated. They'd passed several small towns and isolated farms as they headed upstream from Sarmouth, and every time they'd shouted their warning that the Carizian heretics were attacking up the river. Sarmouth was on fire. Sarmouth Keep had been reduced to rubble. Run, run for your lives. The Carizians are coming. Frankly, Aplin Armark had thought that particular touch would be too much when Sir Duncan came up with it. In fact, it had worked beautifully. It had allowed them to row straight through the daylight hours for the first day and a half and get over 100 miles upriver without anyone wondering what 6 ship's boats were doing that far north of the port. After that, they'd restricted themselves to the night hours, and progress had slowed, but even so, his thoughts chopped off as something flashed blindingly in the shadows ahead of them. There was a solid, meaty thumping sound, and Brayson grunted explosively, then turned his head and looked up at Aplin Armagh with an incredulous expression. He opened his mouth as if to speak, but all that came out was a gush of blood, and then he disappeared into the river as his hands released the gunwale.
"Out of the boat!" Aplin Armagh heard his own voice bark even before the topman lost his grip. "Cutlasses and tomahawks, no muskets. Move, damn you!"
He was talking to an empty boat by the time he got to move, and he heard another bullet thunk into the wood as he snatched up his own sword Baldric, then rolled over the side into the icy water. They'd gotten closer to the shore, and the water was less than armpit deep, but he crouched, keeping just his head above the surface, as he hurriedly slung the Baldric over his shoulder.
"Stewart, hang on to the painter. Don't you dare lose this boat," he hissed at the coxswain. "The rest of you, with me."